listening to Food Rebels, and I'm your host, AJ Sharp. As you know, this is the show dedicated to the more rebellious side of the food world, where we celebrate the people who have challenged the status quo. And have we got a food rebel for you today? You know me, I'm the show host, AJ Sharp, taste expert, food writer, great taste judge, business owner. But first, I want to introduce you to Dhruv Baker, who is a food rebel in his own right. Dhruv is the founder of award-winning company Tempest Foods, charcuterie, amazing award-winning charcuterie, and the winner of MasterChef 2010. Hi, Dhruv. So great to have you here.
Hey, AJ. Good morning. Lovely to be here.
So great. Can you tell us a little bit about your food story?
Yeah, I mean, I think professionally my food life was turned upside down in 2010, post-MasterChef. But before that, there'd always been a connection to food. I was always, you know, people use the word obsessed, but I was. It was something that I found fascinating. I was curious. I think anyone who genuinely loves food is curious by nature. And I just wanted to know more about how food became what it ended up as opposed to ingredients. And the older I got, the more and more it felt like a pipe dream. It wasn't, in inverted commas, a real job, perceived as a real job. You know, after university, it was expected that it was banking or finance or, you know, something that I desperately didn't want to do. And then thankfully, post-MasterChef, I got this insight into all of the amazing myriad of jobs available within food. You know, from an outsider looking in, you think you can either be a food stylist or a chef and that's it. But actually, that's completely not the case. And I think a lot of potential talent is lost because they don't realise. So that got me into the world of food. And then subsequently, I owned a restaurant. I wrote a couple of cookbooks. I presented a couple of TV shows for National Geographic in Croatia. And now Tempest is my 9-to-5. Well, it's not.
It's your baby.
It's 24/7. But yeah, Tempest charcuterie. I mean, I still love the presenting and the judging and the demonstrating, the chefing side of things that still comes with it. But fully immersed into the wonderful world of food. And I get to do things like this, which is always a joy.
Well, you are going to love the expert we have in the studio today. This week, we have Craig Sams joining us. Now, Craig is an organic pioneer. He founded Whole Earth Foods, Green and Blacks. He has had an enormous effect on the UK food industry, and we're going to find a little bit more about this today. Welcome, Craig. So great to have you.
Good morning.
Hello.
Nice to be here.
So where should we start with your story? Because there's so many different elements to it.
How about Kabul in Afghanistan?
In Afghanistan, okay.
Just because when I was at university, I took a year off and just to travel. And in the travels, I got quite unwell with dysentery and then hepatitis, which came on from the dysentery. And that was in Iran, where I learned that the cure for dysentery was unleavened whole wheat flatbread and unsweetened tea. But as I traveled on into Pakistan and India, they didn't have unleavened whole wheat flatbread. And the symptoms recurred, and by the time I got to Delhi, I actually had hepatitis. I carried on traveling, and from Peshawar in Pakistan, I took a bus to Kabul, and there they had the same kind of unleavened flatbread as in Iran, and the dysentery was cured, and the hepatitis wasn't so bad. I carried on and ended up back at university in September, met some friends who were into the macrobiotic diet. I adopted the diet, and I suddenly, all the symptoms of the fatigue and liver pain and the yellow eyeballs and that sort of thing disappeared, and I became a convert to the macrobiotic diet basically for life and have followed it ever since. In February of the following year, I visited the Paradox restaurant in New York, and I had one of those moments where I said, this is what I want to do. Came back to London, where my mother lived, and started propagating the idea of macrobiotics. There was a club that had opened that was called the UFO Club. It was where the Pink Floyd got their start and bands like the Soft Machine, and where the kind of emerging, I hesitate to use the word hippie, but it's the word that describes it, scene, was emerging. And so I supplied the food. And so people would go down, listen to the Pink Floyd, and then go and get something to eat and be confronted with brown rice rissoles and falafel and stuff that they never really seen before. And I had a couple of friends then who would work with me telling people why sugar was bad for you and brown rice was good for you, and generally just doing a little bit of messaging. By February of 66, I had opened a small restaurant in Notting Hill, and that really took off. And later that year, my brother joined me in the business. I'd found much larger premises for a bigger restaurant, and that was known as Seed Restaurant. It was in sort of between Paddington and Bayswater in London, and it became very trendy. You know, John Lennon and Yoko and Terence Stamp and people like that were regulars at the restaurant. And we did a full range of macrobiotic food, and we had an urn of green tea that you could help yourself to as much as you liked. People started saying, look, I don't want to have to come here every time I want to eat brown rice. Can I buy some from you? So we started packing the foods and selling it to people who came to the restaurant. And then as my brother Gregory got a shop together in All Saints Road in Notting Hill. And it was the first, well, it was called Ceres Grain Shop. And for a while, the health food trade used the term grain shop to describe the other shops that were opening up like it, that really focused on, you could go in and buy brown rice, millet, buckwheat, seaweed, miso, all these foods that nobody had ever seen before. And we started wholesaling to other shops that were opening up like that. And then health food shops wanted to get on board. And so they would buy our pre-packed brown rice and other grains and Japanese foods, because macrobiotics had a strong, the book about macrobiotics was called Zen Macrobiotics, and that was the idea. So we started, and we also sold patchouli, because the same people who ate brown rice and kombu seaweed and miso also tended to prefer patchouli as a fragrance. We had the shop on Portobello Road. We called the wholesaling company Harmony Foods, and that was our brand. We opened a bakery next door to our shop in Portobello Road that was the first bakery to do sourdough bread. My brother would buy wheat from farmers who were members of the Soil Association. There wasn't any certification in those days, but you assumed that they were organic. He would mill it on a stone mill that we had in our warehouse, and then the flour would come to the bakery and we'd bake organic whole wheat, sourdough, and rye and other breads. We did use white flour, but only for the crosses on the hot cross buns. But otherwise, we were 100% whole grain.
Fantastic.
That carried on. And then, you know, more people jumped into the business. Stuff like brown rice and beans were a commodity. We'd created the first sugar-free jams, which were sweetened with apple juice, approved by the British Diabetic Association. Our peanut butter was really going well, but the other products were, anybody ultimately could put brown rice in a bag or beans or whatever. My brother created something called the Veggie Burger. Nobody had ever used the word before, so...
What kind of year was that then?
That was in 81.
81, okay.
And we trademarked the name because it hadn't been... You know, you can't trademark something unless... It's an original word.
Right.
And so we launched the Veggie Burger, but we were struggling financially. We were a little bit too big for our boots. So my brother took the Veggie Burger out of the company and ran with that and was very successful with it. I licensed all of the brown rice and beans, what were the Harmony brand products, to another company, and concentrated on peanut butter and jam, and took that through the 80s. Peanut butter was very successful. We launched the first organic peanut butter, and it was in Tesco and doing really well. I was looking for another source of organic peanuts because we were struggling with the one we had. Found some farmers in Africa, in Togo, who were producing organic peanuts. They weren't good enough for our peanut butter, but they also had cocoa beans.
Wow.
And that led me into the chocolate business.
So just before we move on, so the peanut and the jam and the rice, was that the start of Whole Earth Foods?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's and then that then grew into its own entity that we know today.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And what I did until, we used to say peanut butter oil separation is natural, just stir it back in.
Mm.
The alternative was to use hydrogenated fat, which...
Or palm oil or something.
Well, hydrogenated fat gives you heart disease. Palm oil doesn't. And in those days, palm oil was not the sort of vilified ingredient it is now.
Mm.
In fact, most of the palm oil that comes into Europe gets burned. It's biodiesel. Yeah, which is, I think, just revolting that you take food, you deforest Indonesia, take food, and then mix it with diesel because it's renewable and, you know, somehow that's virtuous. But EU regulations subsidize that sort of thing. And, you know, we burn rapeseed oil here in England. You know, you see fields of wheat and barley. They get turned into ethanol and mixed with petrol, but... I don't know if you want me to complain about that, but I just think, you know, a child dies every 7 minutes of hunger, an adult dies every 5 minutes of hunger somewhere in the world, and we're burning food.
Burning food, it's insane.
It's old. It's just the way we subsidize agriculture that needs changing.
Mm.
But I used palm oil, that's why I'm defending it, to stabilize the peanut butter. And that meant you didn't have oil separation, and then Whole Earth Foods went on to be the number one peanut butter.
Fantastic.
The chocolate, we'd, having just celebrated in 87, 20 years of no sugar in our, in our range. When I read a book called Dine Out and Lose Weight by a guy called Michel Montignac that had the concept of glycemic index. So not, it was what something does to your blood sugar. Glucose is 100.
Mm.
That's the standard. Brown rice was 65 because it takes longer to break down. Whole wheat bread is somewhere around there as well. 70% dark chocolate was 22, so quite low. So when I was dealing with the farmers in Africa who had the peanuts and the cocoa beans, we got a sample made of a 70% chocolate to see what it would be like. My girlfriend came back to my place, took one bite. She was a journalist at the time. And just said, this is the best chocolate I've ever tasted. You know, you have to do it. I said, but it's got sugar and how are we going to, Anyway, we did it. And I thought some brilliant names for it, Eco Chalk, Bio Chalk, Natu Chalk. And she said, what about green and black? Green because it's organic and black because it's the darkest chocolate on the market.
Oh, I love that.
So we launched it in August, September of 91. We got married in November of 91. And she really put her heart and soul into getting word out about the brand and through her network of journalist allies, all of whom spend most of their lives writing about other people doing stuff. So they were quite excited that one of their number actually was doing something herself.
They're friends, yeah. So this is your wife, Josephine.
That's right, yeah, Jo Fairley.
Yeah.
And
she was the co-founder then of Green and Blacks with you.
Of the chocolate brand.
And at that time, chocolate... You know, 1991, I mean, I was about 10 or 11 at that time. It was just Cadbury's, wasn't it? Or Bourneville.
Well, Bourneville was 34% cocoa solids, so half the cocoa solids. And it wasn't even 34%. It was 20% cocoa mass and 14% cocoa butter.
Mm.
So you didn't have any challenging, bitter, chocolatey type flavors. We did send a sample to one supermarket chain, who I won't name, who sent it back unopened with a bar of cooking chocolate, which was 49%. Basically, the message was, you know, don't be silly, boys. You know,
we've already got cooking chocolate.
Yeah,
lives.
We've got cooking chocolate, and people won't eat this kind of stuff.
They just thought
stuff.
There wasn't a market at all.
They didn't think there would
really
be.
Dark chocolate.
Yeah, but they were wrong, and they realized they were wrong, and you know, stocked it.
It's just almost unfathomable, isn't it, to think that there was a time where it wasn't part of the mainstream kind of culinary landscape. You know, we grew up with Green and Blacks, and to think of a time when somebody wouldn't recognise for what it is now, and I think that's the beauty about when people kind of really disrupt any given space. It's they do something which everyone goes, oh, that'll never work. And the amount of times, and some it takes that sort of pioneering mindset to stick with it and to despite everyone saying this is a terrible idea, it's never going to work, but to go with it,
yeah.
I think, you know, thank goodness people have done that. But can you imagine a world now where our dark chocolate was what it was then? If that was our option, I think it's a pretty bleak yeah. Landscape we've just thought about.
Mm. Yeah, no, and a lot of people have piled in. And once you get to that level of intensity, then the origin of the cocoa beans starts to come through, and how you process them, you know, how you roast them and that sort of thing, and how well they're fermented on the farm. And that's complicated because you're dependent on lots of small farmers in remote locations. So you have to invest a lot in training them to make sure that the fermentation is perfect, because that's where a cocoa bean is transformed into what makes good chocolate. If you don't ferment your cocoa beans, as some American companies still don't do, wow, you struggle with the flavor notes that you want to get in a good chocolate.
Did you grow up in America or Canada or somewhere?
I was born in Nebraska, which is right in the middle of America. My grandfather was a farmer, and my mother... It was during the war, so my dad was fighting in the Pacific, and my mother was milking cows in Nebraska, and I was born. And then the war ended, and we went and lived in California. And then my dad, who was at UCLA University, graduated, got a master's degree, and got a job with the American Defense Department as a historian, and we came to live in England. So I lived in England in the 50s.
Wow. That must have been quite a change from Nebraska.
And California. Well,
and California.
LA had smog.
Yeah.
London had fog.
Yeah.
So it's amazing. I can breathe at all, given the crappy air that I had as a child. But yeah, so then we lived in England, Germany, Pittsburgh, Omaha, Châteauroux, France, London. And my mother stayed here in London from the 1960s onwards. So I would go to university every year, come home from my summer holidays in England. So at that time, there's the trad jazz scene and then the mod scene. And, you know, the musical scene was quite advanced here compared to Philadelphia, which was pretty cool, but, you know, not that cool. And then I graduated and came to London to pursue my career propagating macrobiotic healthy eating.
I mean, with hindsight, it all makes perfect sense. One step led to the other. There does seem to be this linear trajectory. But at the time, at times, did it all feel kind of disjointed and a bit kind of haphazard is the wrong word. But, you know, if you attribute a formula to it now, it makes sense. But at the time, were you kind of thinking, you know, we're onto something here, but is there a plan, or was there a plan, or was it stuff that sort of happened organically?
I think the original idea was just a restaurant, but then that morphed into selling prepacked food at the restaurant, that morphed into a retail shop. Other retail shops like it meant that, you know, they came to us and said, where can we get brown rice? Where can we get miso? Where can we get kombu seaweed? And so we started wholesaling to them. Our mother, Margaret, played a significant role in that. When I sold food at the UFO Club, she made it, and I'd take it down there and hand it over to the bar and then party away. And likewise, when we started packing food, she oversaw the production line. So she'd get a, there were a few women, well, originally neighbors of hers from Ealing. And then when we moved our warehouse to Bermondsey, women from Bermondsey, and she would oversee the assembly line, if you like, where we packed stuff, put it into cartons and that sort of thing, while my brother and I got our heads around marketing it and encouraging the health food trade to open up. Our sales guy was someone called Jay Landisman, who renamed himself Stan Stunning for this particular role. And he would call up health food shops and say, "Oh, hello. Have you noticed people with long hair and colorful clothes coming in and asking for foods like brown rice and miso and kombu seaweed?" And the retailers would say, "Well, yes, I have," because people would go into shops asking for that stuff. He said, "Well, we have it for you." And we had an introductory package that had brown rice, buckwheat, millet, adduki beans, kombu seaweed, miso, tamari, soya sauce, and we also had patchouli on our list. And so the shop could get a sort of introductory pack that enabled them to get the stuff on their shelves. Mm. And then once that happened and it sold, they would reorder full cases, and we had momentum.
Amazing.
That as a starter pack today wouldn't be out of place. You know, if you think about all the ingredients you've listed today, you could see it as a iteration now. Yeah. What are we, 30 more years on? And
I don't know how much it's actually progressed since you'd had that original idea.
Sexier packaging. But actually, the idea, you know.
But fermented foods, it's almost been the last 3 to 5 years that it's really become mainstream.
Yeah.
Well, miso, finally. I mean, we introduced miso. We had to explain everything to people.
Sure.
You had to explain why brown rice. In those days, there was still a term for brown rice that was rice that had been parboiled. So it was because they realized that white rice was nutritionally deficient. So they would soak it in hot water, and some of the goodness of the bran would go into the grain. So, in fact, when we launched it, we called our brown rice whole rice to differentiate it from...
Ah, that makes sense.
From unwhole white rice or parboiled rice. Yeah, no, things have moved on just unbelievably. And, you know, I think there are certain things have changed. Bread of all kinds is much healthier than it was in those days. Mm. Brown rice is better than white rice. The amount of hydrogenated fat we ate in those days. Doctors were telling people in the 1980s, "Oh, you've got you've got cholesterol. Stop eating butter and eat margarine." And it was a death sentence. Yeah. Because the margarine was 32% hydrogenated fat, which is a form of plastic made out of oil, but that gives the structure to a block of margarine. And Denmark banned hydrogenated fat in 2003. Their heart disease deaths went down 60%.
Wow. Ours started rising exponentially.
Well, now they're going down because nobody eats it anymore. But when you think of how many doctors across the country were taken in by that particular story and told people to stop eating a healthy food like butter to eat an unhealthy food. I mean, now margarine is all made with coconut oil, palm oil, shea butter, whatever, but it's not, you don't get hydrogenated fat anywhere anymore.
You and Josephine, you set up this business. You were the first products to carry the Fair Trade mark. Is that right?
Next year is the 30th anniversary of the Fair Trade mark.
Wow.
Fair Trade Fortnight is in March, because in March of 1994, we launched a product called Maya Gold that was based on... It was grown by Maya farmers in Belize. I had gone to a ceremony, the Deer Dance, which is a Maya, his 4-day dance that they do. And on the night before the final day of the dance, they had a ceremony where the prioste or shaman would pass around a cup of cocoa that was flavored with allspice and a leaf called Choicia ternara that we call Aztec mock orange. So I tried to emulate that flavor with orange extract, spices, and basically our chocolate that we already had. We called it Maya Gold. The Fair Trade Foundation went out, saw the deal that we had set up with the Maya farmers. They were getting 55 cents a pound for their cacao, and it wasn't enough. They were abandoning their plantations. I offered $1.25, which seemed like a lot to them. In fact, we ended up raising it to $1.75, which is more than three times what they were getting from the American company that was buying their beans. Mm. I don't want to mention their name. You don't want me to be...
You can probably guess.
And so the Fair Trade Foundation were happy, and it was the first ever product to come out with a fair trade mark. And once it came out, it got so much positive publicity that supermarkets who had turned us down previously, suddenly they wanted green and blacks. People like Equal Exchange and Tradecraft, the fair trade companies that didn't carry the mark, because they felt that was only really for the capitalists, so to speak. You know, they all jumped aboard, and suddenly the fair trade mark was on tea, coffee, obviously chocolate, sugar, and bananas. And that kind of laid the foundations for fair trade that they will be celebrating next year.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, and it just changed. And in fact, when we sold Green and Blacks to Kraft, who then became Mondelez, the CEO of Mondelez rang me up and said, in the 2010, he said, next week, Craig, I'm giving a talk in Abidjan, and I'm announcing our program, which we've modeled on what you guys did in Belize. We're calling it Cocoa Life, and we're putting $400 million behind it. Well, that was way beyond anything we could ever have done. And that changed the whole face of cocoa production in Ghana and Ivory Coast. And just about a month ago, the Fair Trade Foundation sent out a press release announcing their partnership with Cocoa Life, which they have never, ever partnered with anybody before, but they felt that Cocoa Life was so completely in tune and harmonious with fair trade that they wanted to work with Cocoa Life on moving things forward. So I you know, personally take much satisfaction from the way that the fair trade mark has just moved to such a strong position.
Mm. I mean, that's such an inspiring story, isn't it? And I mean, legacy is a very big word, but that's definitely the word I'd attribute in this case. And I think I've got to put my hands up and say I feel like a terrible guest presenter because I've just not said a word, because I'm just sitting here listening.
I know, same.
Craig's words, because it's fascinating. You know, each of the brands or the products we've looked at, each one has had a profound and monumental effect, a material effect in its own space. And I think to have done it once, people kind of would be pretty proud of it. But to have done it over and over again, I think, Craig, shows something that I find incredibly compelling from as a producer, but also the consumer, to realize that there are products out there which genuinely do set about doing good, as opposed to the greenwash that we've sort of seen so many times. I think from all sides of it, it's just an incredible story, and certainly one that I find
very
really inspiring.
It's ahead of its time, isn't
it? Yeah, I've been wanting to say that, but it was ahead of the curve in so many ways, or all of these, but...
I know, you've got people now launching brands going, we care about your health as well as, you know, the environment. You're thinking, well, actually, there's a lot of people here who've been doing this for decades.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or not a lot of people, but...
Yeah, well, certainly one.
So you and Josephine went on to have some kids, and they've set up their own company, haven't they?
They were the kids from my previous marriage, Rima and Kareem, who set up Gusto. And they We'd had a celebratory party at the Groucho Club in 1987 where I made a very potent non-alcoholic brew of ginseng, Siberian ginseng, a Chinese Taoist monk formula, and guarana. And they took some of that drink and continued to enjoy it for a year or two and then said, why don't you market this? And I said, why don't you? And so they started a soft drinks business called Gusto.
We've got some here, actually, to have a little taste.
Yeah, we have indeed.
Yeah, they look, I mean, the packaging's gorgeous. They are, and the flavours are all intriguing.
Is that okay if we have a little taste of these? What have we got here?
That's the cherry cola.
Cherry cola. Is that a good place to start?
Yeah, why not? That is the world's only cherry cola that actually contains cherries.
Oh, wow.
Well, because you can do it with artificial almond flavour and get a cherry effect. And
so these are real cherry. Oh, wow. That really packs a cherry. You get that kind of almondy effect that you get when you've used whole cherries. Lovely.
I've only really ever had one cola with a cherry note to it. And it just tastes wildly
artificial,
whereas this doesn't. This is, it's kind of, it's not that kind of assault on your palate. It kind of makes sense, and it is delicious.
Delicate effervescence. So have you been involved with Gusto Organic?
Oh, very much so. So my kids launched it, but I already had the infrastructure, warehousing, distribution, etc. They did the sales, and with the original product, it really took off in coffee shops in Holland and Holland and Barrett here and the health food trade. And quite a few sort of coffee houses and bars in Soho and Bristol and places like that. The coffee shops in Amsterdam went crazy for it because their customers would have a bottle of Gusto and it would keep them going for another hour or two. And that was good for business if you were running a coffee shop. But eventually the brand got big and we had outside investors who came into the whole company and they sold Gusto to a Dutch company who've kind of lost the plot. They didn't quite get it. And so I bought the brand back and it's going from strength to strength now.
Fantastic. I mean, what flavours have we got there?
So, I mean, I'll just read them out. I mean, they all sound, as I said earlier, phenomenal. You've got a Sicilian lemon with yuzu. There's the real cola. There's the fiery ginger with chipotle. There's a Sicilian blood orange and the naturally slim cola. But do you think we should... I'm intrigued by this Sicilian lemon and yuzu.
Yeah, I love yuzu.
Yeah, it's just... I'm going to give that a little... Not a shape. I'm just going to turn it over to mix it through. But I think...
Yeah, be that careful. Good.
It's just fizzing
over,
everywhere at the moment.
This is why radio is a better medium than television, because you won't see what I've just done with that. Oops.
It's all right. We've made a flood here on the studio desk. I'm not going to pass you that one, Craig. Don't worry.
Yeah, that
one. Which one?
The one with the meniscus work to the max.
I know what to do with one of those.
Really? Do you know? Well, you have that one. That's
okay.
And I think we'll agree that I won't pour again.
Oh, yeah, the yuzu comes through immediately. That lovely citrus, lemony, orangey, almost guava-y punch. Mm.
There is that, and that amazing florality you get with it. And I think the two, they're balanced perfectly. But, you know, that is incredibly refreshing, I think. Mm. Especially now in the time where a lot of people are choosing not to drink. You know, it's not, you know, coming from an energy drink perspective. I think an alternative to the sort of no and low movement is fairly robust. But I think something like that on a summer's day, you know, in a long glass full of ice, I mean, it's refreshing, but it's got that textural complexity. So it isn't just sugar and sparkling water. There is a lot more to it. I would happily have that of an afternoon.
And it's quite a delicate effervescence, isn't it? And although there's a nice sweetness to it, which I enjoy because it's so many products now, particularly drinks, are not putting any sugar in at all. And you lose body, you lose flavour, you lose depth. But there's not a lot. You finish with quite a clean palate at the end.
Yeah.
Well, the sweetener in all of these drinks is agave.
Mm-hmm. Is it?
Which is a Mexican cactus from which they make tequila. Mm-hmm. But the same agave syrup that makes tequila is also a great sweetener, and it doesn't affect your blood sugar level. It's got a lower glycemic index than glucose or sucrose, sugar. So you can drink the drink without getting a sugar high and the subsequent sugar crash.
This is what I need to be giving my kids, isn't it? Yeah. Rather than honey or whatever.
Well, honey is still basically, in terms of glycemic index, the measure of how something affects your blood sugar. Honey's pretty much up there with sugar. And,
is it? Yeah.
Now, some buckwheat honey isn't, acacia honey isn't, but most honeys are.
Just amazing. I feel like I can listen to you all day.
I'm slightly kind of now just trying to process everything because just understanding or listening to the various strands. But I think there's a kind of real cereal kind of not C-E-R-E-A-L. But yeah, you know, any of the products has kind of gone on to do what looks like genuinely disruptive things in the individuals, but not for the sake of doing. What I like is that the starting point has seems to have been the same, which is in order to do something good for what you're putting into your body. And it's like everything sort of followed from that. It doesn't feel like a manufactured or created narrative. It is one that is 100% makes perfect sense. And I think as a consumer, you kind of realize that there are better alternatives with no compromise on flavor.
But I think from a business point of view, I really notice, you know, we have all these awesome kind of food rebels coming in here to the studio. People where they followed something they genuinely love and they're genuinely passionate about, and you're kind of following it from a, hey, we should do that. Hey, we should do that. Rather than a sort of, we've got a business strategy and we've looked at the insights and we know that this is on the up. You can't have done that because that information can't really have existed at that point. You must have been following this. Brown rice is better. I'm going to explain to you why. And then people were grabbing it and running with it. And then you were starting to drive that from the creation of, you know, you're creating a market, a niche.
Well, there was an American brand back in the 70s called Follow Your Heart, which kind of reflects what you're saying. You know, that I've never really sat down and done that sort of strategic planning. Most of the stuff that I've ever marketed started in my kitchen as feeding myself. In fact, I'm working on a bread project right now, but that's another story.
That's another episode.
That is another episode. Oh, it's amazing. Thank you so much. It's been, I feel like I could sit and listen forever.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unbelievably, we are out of time though. Thank you so much to our brilliant guest, Craig Sams from Green and Blacks and Whole Foods Earth. Thank you for coming in. And thank you to our guest presenter, Dhruv Baker. We're both a bit in awe, I think, now.
I genuinely am. I am very much so. It's been an absolute joy, Craig. Thank you for...
Lovely to talk to you both.
I would have happily listened to that for hours and hours.
Me too.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Food Rebels, which is available on radio stations around the UK. And you can get replays through podcasting apps such as Apple Podcasts, Spotify and Audible. Thanks for joining us. Make sure you taste the rebellion.